It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The United Nations announced this month that there are now 8 billion people inhabiting our planet. Is that a lot or is that not enough? Human population is a complicated topic. Join in on our demographic destiny. What concerns you about the numbers and the future of our planet? 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Kathleen Mogelgaard is here, president and CEO of the Population Institute, which promotes universal reproductive rights and seeks to achieve a world population in balance with a healthy global environment. Kathleen, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
So at 8 billion people, can the planet sustain all of us? Where do you see this?
It is a complicated question. So the impact of humanity on the planet is a combination of a number of different variables. The numbers that we are, the consumption that each of us carries out in our lives, and then the technology that is in place that manages that impact on the planet, whether it's renewable energy or whether it's coal, for example. So the answer to that question is that it really depends on the choices that we make and the options that we have.
And it sounds like, as what you're saying, that it depends on how we function and how we live and, you know, just how the population works in the world. How do you view that functioning in light of people who are really concerned about the slowing pace of population growth? That low birth weights is a much greater risk to humanity than global warming.
Yes. So it's interesting to me that there is a lot of hand-wringing about the slowdown of population growth rates. And I do want to mention that we are not anywhere close to experiencing global population decline. We've sailed past the 8 billion population milestone last week. Demographers at the United Nations tell us that it's likely that we will probably add another 2.4 billion to the planet's population before we level off somewhere maybe in the 2080s. So we're not anywhere close to experiencing global population decline, although we are seeing some countries whose population growth rates have slowed down and some countries whose populations are in decline. And that certainly does have implications for many things across society. It means that our populations in some countries are becoming older, you know, greater proportion of the population in the older age groups, for example. So how do we take care of the oldest members of the of our families in these kinds of situations when we don't have as many, you know, the same proportion of workers in the workforce in the population as we have in the past? That has implications for things like Social Security and other ways that we support an aging population. But these are things that we can plan for if we're thinking about it and understanding those kinds of implications. For me, I am much more concerned about the places in the world where rapid population growth is continuing. So at the Population Institute, we work with partners in the Sahel region of Africa, for example, where many of those countries are on track to double within just a generation. That creates a lot of challenges for things like poverty alleviation, for climate change vulnerability, for food insecurity, and other issues that have implications for folks who are living in those places, but also increasingly has implications for people all over the world, because what we see as people become in increasingly difficult living situations, they're on the move. And this is a trend that we're seeing globally as people are struggling to seek a better life. People are on the move all around the world. And we see that in ways that can create a lot of challenges for security, for civil society. And we really need to be thinking about places where population is growing rapidly and the kinds of programs we can put in place that will help to put the brakes on that population growth and extend rights and opportunities for people.
Oh, that's really interesting because, I mean, we see climate migration and the movement of people due to climate change and the pressures of global warming. But you're also saying that there are implications with population for why people move.
Oh, for sure. you know, as populations in local places grow very rapidly, it puts up a lot of challenges for the local resource base to be able to sustain that population. So, and that, as you mentioned, it comes into conflict with the changes that we're seeing from climate change, whether that's drought or extreme weather events, can have significant implications for agricultural productivity, for example. So in places where there are communities that are reliant on local agricultural systems for their food supply, as the population is growing, and at the same time, changes in the climate are making it more difficult to have sustained farming and food supply, more and more people will be on the move.
Talking about the more than 8 billion people now living on the planet, Kathleen Mogelgaard is president and CEO of the Population Institute. You can join in with your questions and how you see this milestone, 800-642-1234. Let's talk about food for a moment. I mean, obviously, a challenge if the world keeps growing is how to feed everyone on Earth. Does population growth lead to increased hunger?
In many parts of the world, it does. I mean, global hunger is a result of many different factors. But what we have seen in 2021, there were close to 1 billion people globally who were affected by hunger. And this is a trend that is moving in the wrong direction. The last several years, we've seen more and more people each year affected by hunger. Part of that does have to do with a growing world population, but of course there are other factors that affect that as well. And I know in this moment we're hearing a lot about the conflict in Ukraine, for example, disrupting supply chains for agricultural supplies and fertilizer in particular. And that's something that is going to exacerbate global hunger. But the population factor is one that we need to keep in mind, certainly as we think about longer term trends for ensuring that we can reduce the food insecurity that people are experiencing around the world. It's not only a question of food supply, but also the demand on supply that is there. So as we think about a growing world population, it's something that we need to keep in mind as we figure out how we're going to feed a growing human family.
China and India both have more than 1 billion people, and the census estimates show around 333 million people here in the US, making it the third most populous country. How does population growth around the globe affect us where we live? Like, drive this home for us. How does population growth affect life in places like Wisconsin?
Well, part of that, I think, goes back to what we were talking about just a few minutes ago in terms of global mobility, more and more people being on the move as the planet becomes more crowded and as the planet experiences more challenges like climate change and natural disasters or conflicts around the world. So that is something that affects everyone in every corner of the world when we have people who are on the move and people who are experiencing deep hardship or disaster. So that is something that we need to keep in mind that as the world's population continues to add another billion and another billion, we will see more people on the move. We will see more natural disasters, more climate-related disasters, and we may see more conflict. That certainly has geopolitical ramifications and implications for people everywhere. So that is something in a large global sense that we will all be affected by over time. But in a really kind of more conceptual sense, I think there are important dimensions of population growth that relate to the health and well-being of people, and in particular to the rights and status of women. This is something at the Population Institute that we are very interested in because we understand that persistent population growth around the world is often connected to a lack of reproductive autonomy, which is a concept that I think we are all becoming more aware of with what's happening domestically in the United States on reproductive rights, with the overturning of Roe versus Wade and the Dobbs decision by the Supreme Court this summer. And we're having a deeper understanding of what it means to have bodily autonomy and reproductive autonomy in one's life and how that has important implications for our lives as individuals, for our families, for our communities. And when people are unable to exercise that kind of reproductive autonomy, what we see is more unintended pregnancy. We see higher fertility rates around the world. We see ongoing population growth that can really have implications for the health and well-being of people and the societies that they live in and the local environment, as well as the planet as a whole. So I think this is something that no matter where you live in the world, we can have a deeper appreciation for reproductive autonomy, for the need for reproductive rights, and for people to be able to make their own decisions about how they want to have their own reproductive choices in the future.
Kathleen Mogulgaard with us leads the nonprofit Washington, D.C.-based Population Institute as we explore the consequences of our human population, the challenges it creates. Join in on what 8 billion signifies to you, what the trajectory means for our climate, humanity, reproductive rights. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore population growth, what 8 billion people signifies to our planet. Join the conversation with your population questions, comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Kathleen Mogulgaard is president and CEO of the nonprofit Population Institute and stays with us. Let's bring on a call now. Andrew in Palmyra. Andrew, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Hi there. I just had a quick question. So Bill Gates had a TED Talk that he gave in about 2010, 2011. It was called Innovating to Zero. And in his TED Talk, he talked about how through the advancements of vaccines and other medical improvements that the rate or the population of the planet, the growth rate of population could be reduced by 10 to 15%. And I was curious if your guest would support things of that nature as well, or what her thoughts are on that.
Andrew, thank you for the call. Kathleen, your insights there.
It's a really interesting question. I'm not familiar with the TED Talk that Andrew is talking about, but it certainly is the case that dramatic improvements in public health is what has helped us arrive at the 8 billion population milestone. You know, people mm-hmm. are living longer, healthier lives than we ever have before. We've got fewer children dying in infancy. We have fewer mothers dying in childbirth. You know, we've really made remarkable progress in extending people's lives and public health advances. Many of the kinds of public health advances that are supported by the Gates Foundation is something that is really helping to address mortality rates in areas that are remarkable in progress. That progress has been uneven around the world, and it's something that as we pass this population milestone, it's an opportunity to reflect on the places where we've not yet been able to reach everyone with life-saving medications and with public health advances so that people can live longer and healthier lives. And as we have seen, history shows us that over time, as people have greater confidence that their children will survive, and as they have opportunities for education, as they have opportunities for entering the workforce, we do see that fertility rates decline over time. Mm-hmm. And that is something that will put the brakes on population growth and lead to greater sustainability and health and well-being.
I just want to explore the thread on reproductive autonomy. As you see, you know, China officially ending its one-child policy at the start of 2016. They introduced a three-child policy last year. What impact do those government policy interventions and laws have on population and demography? How do you see them?
Well, I think when we look at the different kinds of population control policies that have been put in place in different countries through history, what we see is egregious violation of human rights. And what we see is an attempt to have top-down engineering of demographic outcomes that ends up not serving people very well and ultimately not serving countries very well. With the example of China that you've just raised, they have some significant demographic challenges now with the aging population, with a smaller workforce, and there are deep concerns about how their demographic age structure will be able to sustain their economy. You know, it's really been a challenge for China to have that kind of population control policy. So I think what we believe at the Population Institute and a lot of groups working in this space really truly believe that the best thing we can be doing is ensuring that people have access to information, that they have a full range of contraceptive options available to them, that they understand fully the different kinds of side effects that can come with different contraceptive methods, and that people really can make the choices that are the best for them, that they can afford the care that they need when it comes to their reproductive health and family planning options. And that within that, you know, that needs to be nested within situations where women have autonomy in their lives and the ability to make these kinds of decisions that are well supported and that they have options on the table before them. And when we do see these conditions in place around the world where women have options in their lives, where girls have been able to go to school, and where there are robust reproductive health and family planning services available to people, we do see fertility declining in ways that puts the brakes on population growth.
Talking with Kathleen Mogelgaard, President and CEO of the Population Institute, looking at the milestone of 8 billion people on the planet. Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Kathleen, how can the U.S. help parts of the world that are experiencing rapid population growth? What can we do?
Historically, the United States government has been a real leader globally in providing support for countries that are interested in expanding reproductive health and family planning services to their populations. This has been a real success story of U.S. foreign assistance through the decades. But unfortunately, what we've seen in the last decade or so is that the U.S. government's support for reproductive health and family planning programs as part of our foreign assistance has stagnated. We've leveled off in our funding and our support for these kinds of programs around the world. And yet, during this decade that our funding has stagnated, we've seen the largest generation in history entering their childbearing years. So I think it's really important that we continue to send signals to our own government that these kinds of investments in reproductive health and family planning that help people achieve reproductive autonomy in their lives all around the world are really worthwhile investments for the health and well-being of people and their families and their communities, but also something that helps to set us on a path toward greater sustainability in terms of future population growth. So to me, that's something that the United States can be doing, is reclaiming their leadership role in the support that they provide in foreign assistance for reproductive health and family planning services.
Kathleen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I've enjoyed this conversation, and I hope that we'll be able to continue to have really important conversations about population and implications for society.
Yes, Kathleen Mogelgaard is CEO of the nonprofit Washington, D.C.-based Population Institute. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now we look at ways to food style our Thanksgiving table. Tips to help make this meal, and any meal really, look as good as it tastes. Join in on turkey presentation. Join in on side dishes that add color. Questions about garnishes, adding flair, pizzazz. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jim Rood has been a food stylist for more than 30 years. He owns a Wisconsin-based food consultation firm. Jim, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you for having me.
So does all the buildup of, you know, of the Thanksgiving table, does that excite you? Or is that perhaps more pressure than you would care to have with food?
Well, it does. I enjoy Thanksgiving like everybody else does. Unfortunately, sometimes I spend a little bit too much time thinking about how it looks, and probably put more pressure on myself than anything else.
When I look at the pictures of Thanksgiving spreads in magazines, I'm like, ha, I'm not falling for that trick. Do you use real food as a food stylist? I mean, are there a lot of things that you do to turkeys when you get it ready for photography versus what we're putting on the table?
Absolutely. Over the years, I've styled a lot of turkeys for packaging and for advertising and magazines and so forth. And there are a lot of steps that food stylists use that the average consumer, when they're making their Thanksgiving turkey, would never dream of doing.
I've even heard that the turkey is barely baked.
Yes, that's true. if you were to cut into a photo turkey, it would be like more like turkey sushi.
Oh, nasty. Okay, so what are your tips to make the turkey have a beautiful presentation, our fully cooked turkey have a beautiful presentation? What would you suggest?
Well, for the amateur out there who doesn't have to make it look good and sit on a photo set for hours, there's some basic things that I think are helpful that can make a turkey look good, but not necessarily and be edible. And there's the big key there. As a food stylist, we color turkeys with browning liquids and kitchen bouquet and use soaps and different and pin it and put all kinds of things on the turkey that really wouldn't make the turkey taste very, very good. But if I had to go through steps on how to, what the average person could do, obviously washing the turkey well will help that skin kind of brown evenly. Patting it dry before you do anything with it. If you see turkeys in the store, the cavity by the breast it's not all puffed out like you see in the photos. There's a cavity there. But if you fill that cavity with different vegetables or citrus or herbs and such, and then secure that skin underneath with some skewers, as it bakes, that the front of that turkey will stay big and plump looking, which is really one of the keys for when we do photography for using turkeys on how that looks so plump and beautiful.
So when you, keep going. I'm writing these down. Okay. Yes.
So another key with that is just to, you're going to tie the legs to make those kind of sit upright and that'll help when the turkey bakes, obviously. And you can use the turkey always comes with a plastic insert that is the legs are attached to, and that is able to be used in the oven if you need to. So filling the inside cavity again with onions and carrots and celery and citrus and herbs, whatever you enjoy using. That'll add flavor to the turkey, but also make that nice and big, and will keep that turkey from kind of sinking as it bakes or as it roasts in the oven. And then a lot of people like to put stuffing in the turkey. It's kind of an old, I think my mom used to do that, and I don't recommend doing it that way, but that's an option for filling the turkey, but I think it's better to fill it with aromatics and vegetables to do that.
Do you remove that cavity stuffing amalgamation that you put together, whether it's citrus or herbs or vegetables? Do you remove that before that turkey hits the table, or do you keep it in there?
Well, I guess I usually leave them in there, and the reason being, if you're carving the turkey, you really don't get to the inside cavity. All the meat you're looking for is on the outside. And if you're presenting, let's say you're just presenting the turkey on the platter, like the traditional look is everybody wants to see the beautiful turkey on the platter. Then just putting some fresh herbs and some fresh garnish on top of that cavity can kind of, make it look beautiful, but trying to scoop out all of those aromatics on the inside can be a kind of a messy ordeal. Deal with that when it's done being carved.
Okay, so you mentioned garnish. Let's go deeper here on garnish. What are your suggestions for adorning that turkey on the platter?
Well, whenever you're garnishing a turkey, you almost need to think of it more as an art project. So, I like to use different textures, different shapes, different colors, and use seasonal vegetables and fruits to do that. I think fruits work the best because they have such a variety of colors and textures that you can use. So, I like to use clementines, oranges, lemons, different berries. Cranberries work great for that. Red onions, lots of herbs. And there's the herbs that work the best for that, I think, are probably your sage, rosemary, thyme. Parsley can get a little limp if it's subjected to a lot of heat, but if you're going to use parsley, use curly parsley. It holds up a little better.
Talking about how to make our meals look as beautiful as they taste, we have a Wisconsin-based food stylist, Jim Rood, and we're getting tips and tricks to the Thanksgiving table. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Jim, how should that turkey be carved? Do you carve it before it hits the table, or do you want to do it at the table? Any suggestions there?
Well, every family is a little different, and some people love to have the presentation of the whole turkey before it's carved and carve it tableside. But personally, I think it works better and you get a hotter product if you pre-carve it and then nicely display the meat on the platter. That way, you can even keep it warm in the oven prior to right when everybody's ready to eat. It also makes it easier. You can carve that turkey on a separate board, break it down into separate pieces. And I've done some videos actually on how to do that on the Jennie-O Turkey site. Breaking down the legs, the thighs, the breast, and then carving those separately makes it a little easier than trying to carve off of a whole turkey.
Okay. How about the dishware that people are eating from? What are your tips for matching the meal to the dishware?
Well, again, we're kind of we're looking for colors and textures and plates and bowls that fit the amount of food that you're preparing. So, I'd like to. We all seem to struggle with plate space, right? Or with table space and how much food we can get on a table. Well, when you're picking a turkey, keep in mind the size of the platter, or vice versa, the size of the platter to go with the size turkey. And, you know, everybody has their own dishware, but I like to have the food be the element that pops on the table, and not have really decorative plates and bowls and stuff. Let the food sing.
There's such an urge, though, to reach for the china cabinet and pull out grandma's china. And there are so many different pieces that normally even aren't on a typical table for dinner. And so that table gets really cluttered. Are there some essential pieces or dishes that are more helpful than others? I mean, do we need all the butter roll dish and this dish and that dish?
Well, there is something special about bringing out grandma's china and doing it that way. And I think maybe the best way to do that is to have your food in a separate location that people can either dish up or serve themselves. And that frees up that table to have maybe more plateware or more serving dishes and different things, or at least be able to, you know, kind of work around that a little bit. So, you know, the beauty of Thanksgiving is everybody has a different tradition, and you don't have to feel like you have to compromise that. Just find ways around it.
Do you also cram flowers or settings, table, you know, candles or other decorations on the table, name cards? What do you suggest there?
Well, hopefully you know most of the people that are at the table.
Who sits where?
You may not need the name cards, but, you know, it's, I think, again, it's the candles, I think, are nice. But if it's a bright afternoon and you're eating during the day, not necessary. But having obviously nice glassware, and for your wine or your water glasses is great. We always like to use our fine silver as serving dishes. But the just picking the right size dish for the, whether it's the cranberry relish or the Brussels sprouts or green bean casserole, sometimes just a nice little touch on that can make all the difference.
We're talking with Wisconsin-based author, chef, and food stylist Jim Rood on pro tips for food styling, tips and tricks that can make our holiday table memorable. Join in on making the food on your table look as fabulous as it tastes. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here as we get tips on making dishes full of color and creativity. Charcuterie boards that guests will want to replicate for future gatherings. That's where we're going next. We learn about a food stylist hacks that we can put to use now. Join in how you make your turkey, your dishes look fantastic. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Wisconsin-based food stylist and recipe creator for decades, Jim Rood, stays with us. Jim, you have some ideas about boards, charcuterie boards, butter boards. What can you tell us?
Well, they are all the rage now, Kate. So you know, get your boards and get lots of them, because anything you want to put on a board, you can do. And that's, you know, for example, a butter board, which even a couple of years ago would have never been, nobody would have ever thought of doing that, right? But now they're, you do a Pinterest search or whatever, whether it's, you know, savory items mixed with sweet items. I think it's an unusual but really wonderful idea, especially for the holiday season.
So with the butters, like, are you making these butters, or are you going to the store and finding different variations on butter? Like, how does this board come together?
Well, it obviously starts with the butter, which I recommend, of course, a really wonderful creamy Wisconsin butter. We do live in a dairy state, so why not emphasize that? So start out with a high fat, European style butter, and I like to go with an unsalted butter for that because you can always add the flavorings to it. Bring it to room temperature, and then adding shredded cheese and different herbs, garlic, and spices. Then you just spread that mixture onto a board and throw some ingredients around it, like you would a charcuterie board, such as tomatoes or avocado or charcuterie meats, prosciutto, different vegetables, and or different spreads. And then you just spread that butter on a really nice homemade bread or artisan bread slices, top it with the other ingredients, and you've got a really great tasty treat.
So do you see these boards as like a mainstay on the Thanksgiving table, or are they more appetizery? How do you incorporate them with the meal?
Well, I kind of think of them as more appetizer or beginning. However, because of the way Thanksgiving goes, there are lots of opportunities to, grandma's homemade rolls, homemade breads, different croissants and things. So you could make a small version of a butter board instead of having the plate, just the plate with the butter on it.
You use the stems of herbs to make lollipop-looking cheese balls. Can you walk us through that?
If you think of butter as just a foundation, and you form that, or use a scoop to form the ball, like an ice cream scoop, then you can chop your herbs and or even different spices and different things, and roll the butter in those different flavorings and different herbs, and then put those on the plate. Now you've got a variety of flavors that you can add that really enhance a meal and make it something special.
You love your herbs, don't you?
I wrote a cookbook, so I would hope I like my herbs. That goes way back.
How should people use a sauce or a glaze on a dish? What would you suggest? Because, those glazes or sauces can be tricky. Some people like them on the side and not right directly on the dish.
Are you like referring to the Thanksgiving meal or in
Yes.
general? Okay. Well, I think with Thanksgiving, the challenge is always the gravy, right? So, how do we keep it from being lumpy? How do we make it look appealing and not just a bunch of light brown, thick liquid? So, personally, I'd like to have use carrots in the pan when I'm roasting the turkey, so that when that cooking stock or that liquid from roasting the turkey, as that cooks, the carrots break down, and they you can blend that stock with and thicken it with some butter and flour to make a roux for that, and then that those carrots will color that gravy really nicely, so you don't have the necessary or need to color it by artificial means.
How do you food style gravy?
Probably the biggest trick I use for gravy is adding churro syrup. So you use corn syrup, and it makes it look glossy and thin without changing the consistency of it too much. Don't do that at home.
Can't believe you're revealing this, but that's on you. I love it. I love it. Let's go to Christy now in Stevens Point. Christy, hi, go ahead.
Hi, this is a great show. I'm looking forward to Thanksgiving. I just wanted to share an idea that me and my family did a few years ago. I don't remember how how the idea came about. It might have been Facebook. Somebody shared it. But we did a relish tray with all the different vegetables, but we set it out to look like a turkey. So it was like the carrots and the peppers and all the things were fanned out to kind of look like the turkey's feathers. And we used a zucchini to be the little, you know, head and neck of the turkey, and olives for the eyes and stuff. So I just thought that was a fun thing for us to do, and the kids loved being part of it.
I can totally see that, Christy. Thank you so much for that. Jim, have you styled a relish tray to look as a turkey?
I have not. I'll have to try that one. I have done cheese and cracker boards, and different boards to look in turkey shapes for companies like Sargento. So, you know, if you want boards and or different holiday ideas, they have some great ideas.
We only have a few seconds left, but any supplies that we should have on hand to style a beverage?
Ooh, well, you know, again, with beverages, I think the key is the glass, mm-hmm. and the mixers. During the holidays, I like to use ingredients that are seasonal. So cranberries, making like a cranberry simple syrup is a great way to kind of add some color and that cranberry flavor to a cocktail, if you're doing, say, a martini.
Mm-hmm,
If you like an old fashioned, which us Wisconsinites definitely do, adding some homemade or some fresh apple cider, or reducing that down and using that as a simple syrup or a flavoring.
All right. Well, Jim, thank you for joining us.
You are welcome. And thank you for having me. And make sure you have a wonderful Thanksgiving.
You as well. Jim Rood, food stylist for more than 30 years. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.